The floor is open for questions. Please introduce yourself when you do ask a question. Bethel.
Bethel Charkudian.
Bethel
Charkudian.
Okay.
And I have a question as to what culture did the Muslim, what religion did the Muslim religion replace? And did it, in fact, broaden or ease the burden on women? Or, I don't want to call it burden, sorry, ease the approach to women? Or did it make it stricter?
Well, this is a very big question, and we have an expert here on women in Islam. But I think the situation is double. And correct me, Natana, if I'm wrong. But the situation is double. On the one hand, I think what Islam did in comparison with the culture that came before it is it was much more directive in terms of gender relationships and formalizing what was much more loose relationship in the period before that. So it formalized, you know, the inheritance for women, marriage situations, and so on. All of those things came to be much more clear with the beginning of Islam than in the period before it. You know, Muslim feminists often argue that the situation was in fact much better for women after the coming of Islam than it was before. My sense is that before Islam became established, it was, you know, Saudi Arabia was a tribal, context where every tribe had a different ethos with regard to gender relationships, and in some tribes, women had more authority and in other tribes less. But insofar as it was a tribal culture, you know, it also came with all the kind of tribal dynamics also. So would you agree broadly with that?
I think that's an interesting way of putting of formalizing relationships in particular, not just inheritance, but also with respect to marriages. There's some research that's been done that indicates that plural marriage was available for both men and women prior to the rise of Islam, which we'll call them the standard Islamic narratives don't like to talk about that. And they will try to make the argument that Islam brought many benefits for women. Prior to the rise of Islam, a man could have an unlimited number of wives, so the Islamic tradition limited it to four at most at a time. The Quran also prohibited female infanticide, which was a normal practice, because girls were considered to be a burden to the family to raise and would marry outside of the family and raise children who would be attributed to another tribe or unit. So that was considered to be a bit of a problem. Where I find that the narrative falls apart a little bit has to do with the pre-Islamic and post-Islamic era. And if you look at two of the prophets' wives in particular, before the revelation of Islam, he was married to one woman for 25 years and only to that woman, Khadija. Muslims talk with pride about how she was a wealthy businesswoman, ran her own caravans, hired Muhammad as an employee, but his wives after the rise of Islam did not have the opportunity to engage in those kinds of commercial activities as independently. So I think there were some benefits and some limitations that came about. So try to be holistic, as you said, and a bit self-critical. I think it's important.
Good. Thank you, Natana. Glad you're here. Yeah, Lisa.
This is on the point. Oh, my name is Lisa Cahill, and I teach ethics in the theology department. And I've been involved a little bit in interreligious dialogue, especially through Notre Dame's Kroc Institute, so the Catholic Peace Building Network, and with some of those people that work in different areas, but also a project that they have on Catholicism and Islam. And one of the meetings that I attended was for women, Catholic and Islamic scholars. And to just speak to the issue of what's distinctive and the way you described the conference that you were that you sponsored, I think you can talk about what is distinctive about women without essentializing it to women as women. So a lot of the things you mentioned, like the control of women's sexuality, is historically a fact. It doesn't mean that essentially sexuality more defines women than it does men. It just means that this is a de facto situation out of which women are coming and to which they need to respond. Or there's also, you know, potentially positive characteristics that women or men on the other side might cultivate given historical expectations, like networking at a lower level in the community because they don't have access to sort of unitary authority, which then accounts for why they're accustomed to bridge building and networking instead of being combative, because it doesn't work in the situations they're usually in. And it's an open question whether that's innate. There's actually some, you know, animal studies and so on that indicate there may be some, you know, some sort of inchoate innate gender characteristics. I don't know. I mean, you wouldn't need to take a position on that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I have seen and also heard about a lot is interaction that takes place not in terms of a verbal dialogue about beliefs. So it's not so much the verbal and textual thing, but more women in communities suffering violence or other kinds of stress will sometimes cooperate across interreligious lines for goals that they both think are important.
Mm-hmm.
Like a colleague that I just heard speak at a conference, you know, in June, actually in Sarajevo, but he was saying an example was in Mindanao, the Philippines, where there was conflict between Christians and Muslims. The women would wait for their children outside the same school, and while they were waiting, they started to talk to resolve how they could get their children to school more safely.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's like a distinctive women's. It was a distinctively women's duty, but it doesn't mean it's innate to women.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, those are kind of historical contexts that have allowed women to meet over particular common issues. But then, you know, and I think that's obvious that's a reality. But then the question is, if you have sort of the freedom of speech and contribution to common dialogues, then is there something that women will contribute that will be distinctive? Yeah. So I think those are two different things. What you're saying is right. But is there some way of engaging in any, let's say if we just focus on doctrinal dialogue, is there something that women would contribute that would be innately women's issues? Also, you know, what you're saying is absolutely is important and right, but as I think it's Rosemary Ruther was pointing out, within different religions you also have, you know, women who contribute to a kind of discourse that's very oppressive towards women of other religions, you know, like in India, you know, the Hindutva women who really have developed really ugly ideas and discourse about Islam and Muslim women. So it can also, among women, go either way, given the same historical context, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, you often have, like, with the story of Hagar, women trying to improve their status within the patriarchal system,
mm-hmm.
and doing so over the backs
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
So I'm thinking also.
Can you introduce yourself for everyone, please?
I'm Ellen Messer. I'm an anthropologist. Teach at various universities around town. So I'm thinking along the lines that you were mentioning that that women approach certain issues from their own experience in a slightly different, perhaps more innovative, naive way. They don't necessarily have vested interests, which allows them to build on each other. And I'm also thinking, you're distinguishing the role of scholars, and that's a very distinct role in contrast to the women who are activists, who are finding their way.
Right.
And I'm thinking particularly of women embracing the issue of women's rights are human rights. So that's something that theoretically male lawyers would embrace,
mm-hmm.
but women are going to come at that from a different perspective, particularly if they're coming from a view that's grounded in their own religious understandings.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that building in various international conference contexts. In addition, in the area of food, the association of women with nurturance, at least in Western cultures, Jewish and Christian traditions, while it builds on what is considered to be an ethos that applies equally to males and to females, from their own experience of nurturance, develop a different discourse. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about this as the scholar, as activist, mm-hmm. as one of the ways to be thinking, to be developing the lines of what might be distinctive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think, I mean, that it's what several articles were also pointing to, sort of ways in which women don't necessarily go immediately, even scholar women don't go immediately to doctrinal disagreements, but just try to understand one another also on an experiential level and through participation in each other's lives and so on, and thereby get a more holistic understanding of the other.
Natana.
Natana Dulong-Bas. I was just wondering in relationship to that. since the age factor, if perhaps one of the issues, and I don't know if this came up during the conversation, had to do with expected outcomes, that rather than just looking at the dialogue as the goal in and of itself, that female participants tend to have a different level of expectation as to what the outcome of that dialogue is going to be, as opposed to male participants who you said seem to be a little bit more combative, that it was about, or competitive, presenting the truth of their tradition as their contribution to the dialogue. My experience, at least dealing with Muslim and Christian women, is that there's the desire for something a little bit more. You're just presenting your perspective or having your perspective listened to, but that there's a desire to use that to work on building a relationship into the future. And I wonder, was that discussed at all?
It didn't really come up as a distinctive topic in terms of what the goal is. I mean, it was laid out as a conference that was going to look at women's contribution to interreligious dialogue, whether or not there was anything distinctive that was offered. But I think the kind of relationship building is usually, I mean, it can be an explicit goal. If you start from an academic context, it's always sort of implicit or explicit mm-hmm. that's going to be the result. And I didn't necessarily have the sense that was more the case when women were dialoguing with each other. But there was definitely sort of that atmosphere, as I said, of building on each other and mm-hmm. and establishing sort of friendships across, but there was plenty of disagreement also, you know. I think most female scholars were, or most participants were uncomfortable with Rita Gross's, you know, position that there really was nothing distinctive. But it's one thing to say that and another thing to say what is distinctive then. And I, you know, you have dialogues, of course, on very different levels indeed, sort of you have an academic dialogue, a dialogue of spiritualities, a dialogue of daily life, and a dialogue of social action. If you just stay with all these four ways of doing dialogue, and each of them has its own particular goals and aims. But I don't know if that was particularly the at stake in this academic dialogue.
I had a question that I think maybe others in the room might be able to contribute to as well as you, but thinking more broadly about your work, not thinking about women so much, but as a comparative theologian, I'm wondering whether it says something about Boston College that a comparative theologian is at the head of our Department of Theology, and maybe you could say a bit about why comparative theology is relatively new and. For those who don't know, Catherine is one of the leading lights globally in a relatively new field of comparative theology, and that's notable in itself. What does it say to you that this happens here at Boston College, and maybe other people might have something to say about that as well?
First, for those of you who don't know what comparative theology is, it is indeed a new field of theological reflection where. One does theology, like faith seeking understanding is a classical definition, in dialogue with another religious tradition. So comparative theologians are usually trained in theology and have a background in one other religion. it's hard to have more than that background and do some serious work with another religious tradition. So the aim of comparative theology is to contribute to the dominant theological discourse by looking at what other religious traditions have to contribute to Christian self-understanding. So, you know, in theology, there's been a huge development of recognizing the presence of the Spirit at work in other religious traditions. Well, if we really believe that as Catholics, then we have to open ourselves up to ways in which the Spirit may be at work in other religious traditions. And that's sort of the work of comparative theology. And it's a discipline that has really been pioneered at Boston College, mostly by Frank Clooney, my predecessor, who's now at Harvard and who really developed this as a discipline and opened or started classes in this area and so forth. Now we're at a place in comparative theology where many people are doing it in many different ways, and the kind of work I do is trying to map all the different ways in which comparative theology is done and how I think it should be done. You know, so that's very you know, in terms of the background in comparative theology. So Boston College has really pioneered this. We have a PhD program at Boston College in comparative theology where we train PhD students who have a background in theology and studying other religious traditions and integrating what they learn in Christian theology. I think, you know, I think it's not a coincidence that this is happening at a Jesuit institution where there's much more receptivity to, you know, the presence of the Spirit and God in all things, and so other religious traditions were logically also to be regarded as possible sources of revelation, and especially since the Second Vatican Council, where this was more officially recognized. The Department of Theology, I think, is indeed very, very open, has been sort of very on the progressive side, I guess, of theology in general, and has been receptive to this. My challenge right now is in the department is to see how we as comparative theologians contribute more to the mainstream discourse of theology. One of the dangers of comparative theology is that it becomes its own little niche or its own, you know, discourse, and that everyone does their own thing, but nobody pays much attention, or what we do really doesn't have any effect. If it's really, you know, a kind of theology seek our faith-seeking understanding, and if we really believe that it has to inform the tradition at large, we have to find ways in which it becomes more part of the mainstream discourse as well. But of course, one of the challenges is that, you know, comparative theology itself is so incredibly diverse, right? So I have a colleague who does Buddhism and a colleague who does Judaism and a colleague who does Islam. But within those traditions, they have their specialty. My colleague does Tibetan Buddhism. You know, my other colleague is an Orthodox Jew. My Muslim colleague specializes in Sufi tradition. So, you know, everyone does their own specialty. So how do we continue to talk to each other within comparative theology, you know? And then how do we continue to talk to theologians within the department? So those are the kinds of challenges that I care about and that I'm interested in right now in our moment in history. Sort of how do we maintain the kind of relevance of comparative theology for the general theological discourse? There's been so much exciting work that has happened in comparative theology, and mainstream theology has little or no awareness of it. So, you know, how do we, you know, bring that back to theology and to informing the tradition at large and ultimately the people in the pews, I guess, yeah. So what we see now in terms of comparative theology is, you know, theology of religions is, people are aware of that, that's sort of Christian attitudes towards other religious traditions, but the next step is really the work of learning about the other religions and bringing it back in the tradition. So that's comparative theology is, in that sense, not comparative religion. Comparative religion is a ideally non-normative discourse that tries to understand the particularities of religions and compare similarities and differences. Whereas comparative theology is really aimed to advancing truth and understanding ourselves more deeply and advancing our self-understanding.
Go ahead.
Was that your question? I feel like I've been on a tirade about what comparative theology is. Yeah, I answered
you
why
did.
BC
absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, go ahead.
Toni Curry, a wife of an alum and a parent of an alum.
Great.
I have a question. If you're not in the academic world and you're not in the scholarly world, but dealing in the everyday world, are the voices that would be leading us to comparative theology be like a Richard Rohr or a Rollheiser, more common names to the public? Where do the people in the pews find these ideas? You know, find the beginning of this.
Right.
I mean, we can't jump from here to here
with
the discussion.
Yeah.
But certainly, is Richard Rohr someone that advocates? I mean, someone that would be an example, a reading to read?
I think, I mean, there are more and more scholars of comparative theology who also try to write textbooks that are, responsible in terms of their comparative work and open to, or accessible by people in the pews. So, Leo Lefebvre just brought out a basic book in Interreligious Dialogue or Comparative Theology where, you know, he presents a certain theme and looks at how Christianity and Islam deal with it, and then the Muslim and the Christian respond to each other and so forth. So I think there are more and more textbooks now or basic introductions to comparative theology, to how it's being done. Of course, you know, you have any number of introduction to world religions, that's something different, but comparative theology is really, I mean, and it is a relatively new discipline where we still have to see where it goes and how we're doing it and so on. But it's starting, so that's one resource that I think is specifically in terms of interreligious dialogue, you know, comparative theology, that's more than popular but less than strictly academic.
We can put a reference to that book on our website, and also if there are others that come up in your thoughts or others here in this room who have text that you think might fit this bill. We have a bibliography on our website with the event page from today's event, and there's a little button that says Read More. We already have a bibliography up, but we can add books. We can tag them as non-scholarly books or books for a general audience. Okay? Yes, one question.
Howard McLinden from Campus Ministry. We have at this Catholic Jesuit Institute a growing interfaith community which struggles and is oppressed in many ways by the policies of the institution and the Catholic Jesuit hierarchy. And I'm wondering, as comparative theologians, is advocacy a part of what you do, or are we theologians and we look at the problem and discuss it?
I don't know to which extent my colleagues are involved in advocacy, but I mean, they, insofar as they represent other religious communities, I think they are definitely very active in assisting those communities in different ways, whether with rituals or with leading groups and so forth. I know that Ruth and John McCransky have been, you know, active in those particular ways. On the other hand, there's something about, I mean, I think all of my colleagues are very realistic about the fact that they are at a Catholic and Jesuit university. and that that has some implications. You know, if they would not want to be at a Catholic and Jesuit university, they would go elsewhere. So maybe it has certain limitations in terms of, you know, John McCransky is also the only Buddhist scholar, you know. Well, yeah, now there's somebody else. But anyway, there are very few Buddhist scholars that they can talk to, or Jewish scholars for that matter. So their conversation partners are all mainly Catholic theologians. But it's also something that they have chosen and that they participate in and that they also see the limits of. I mean, we also try to accommodate the needs of, you know, their own rituals and holidays and so on, and don't impose that on them. On the other hand, you know, it's a Catholic university that trains people in Catholic theology, and there's only so much you can do within that broader framework. We do have the courses in Religious Quest, though, where students who can take the core by taking a year-long course in interfaith dialogue, you know, between Christianity and Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. So for students who are not, you know, who don't have, you know, this background in Christianity or are not interested in Christianity, that's a way in which they can fulfill their theology core that opens it up to much more theological way of doing it. And that's, I think, the envy of many other institutions, Catholic institutions, that we have that kind of option or track. So my sense is that my colleagues who do comparative theology and who are not Christians or Catholics, in fact, prefer to be part in a Christian liturgy. I've talked to one person in particular, to be part of a Catholic liturgy than to sort of develop liturgies where everyone says sort of a small thing and nobody really has the chance to really, you know, make themselves known in their fullness, you know. So they would prefer, you know, to just participate in that liturgy and take their students then off campus to other rituals that are more fully reflective of their communities, you see. So I don't know whether we would want to, you know, go out with in full advocacy. Of course, I take seriously your statement that these communities feel oppressed at Boston College, and that's something that I think would be important for campus ministry to address in some way, and I think they are in some ways. But I think as a department of theology, we have really gone out of our way and are very respectful for religious differences. And we also don't, you know, impose a particular religious view. We allow students to express themselves. So I think in that sense, you know, there always has to be some kind of balance between openness and identity and commitment. And I think at least the way we do it in the theology department is, you know, is to be applauded, I think.
Well, I could join you, yeah. We can join in applauding. We're out of time for right now, but you can stick around. Thank you very much, Kevin. You asked for applause and you get it.